Kia ora, this is Lorna Johnson. You're listening to Making Palmy Home on Manawatu People's Radio. Morena, everybody. Now, my guest today is Sita Venkateshwar. Welcome, Sita, and thank you for coming onto the programme. So Sita and I have known each other for quite a long time, actually, since we were both involved with resettling refugees in Palmerston North several years ago now. But Sita, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're doing in Palmerston North at the moment?
Well, I'm an anthropologist and I work at Massey, and I'm in the School of People, Environment and Planning, within which social anthropology sits. And I've been at Massey now for 24 years, and that's been the primary basis for my arrival in New Zealand and the life that I've built around my work and my home here.
So when you came, it was to take up the position at Massey,
yes,
was it?
Yes. Right. I had just finished my PhD, and at that time I was in the US, and I was just randomly sending out applications to wherever there was a vacancy announced. And in the anthropology newsletter that came around every month, there was this position at Massey that was advertised. And so I applied, never thought twice about it. But I was truly taken aback when my advisor got a letter to say that they were shortlisting me and that I should plan a visit here.
Wow.
So that was in 1996, and I came here in June. It was winter. And it was a really interesting process, because there were about, I think, must have been about three candidates that they brought over. We never met. So they carefully arranged our schedules so that our paths never crossed.
So you don't know who they were,
I
your
don't
competitors.
Know who they were. Yeah. But I truly enjoyed that visit, and I felt, and I think I wouldn't be wrong if I then extrapolated that the committee and the department also then felt, we both felt we were the right people for the jobs. I felt I was everything that they were looking for, and I felt that's what they were communicating to me as well. So I was sure they would offer me the position, and when I went away a couple of months later, I was, of course, really anxious by then. 2 months.
2 months, that's quite a long time, isn't it? Is that normal in academic circles?
It possibly is, because you don't realize that there's so many internal processes that they have to go through to finalize a position and make sure there's funds allocated to it and getting approvals at so many different levels. So I suppose it's normal.
Mm. But you would be getting quite twitchy.
I was twitchy and very relieved when it came. So, yes, and I, of course, immediately accepted. But then I arrived here the following year in February. I arrived just the day before Waitangi Day.
Right.
In 1997, and have been here ever since.
Wow. So had you much knowledge or experience of New Zealand prior to your application?
Absolutely not. No. I knew nothing about it. It's just this remote place. And in the circles I grew up in and the academic milieus I was connected to as a young person, as a student, one typically looked westwards from India. So in terms of travel, you look to go to the, or study, you look to go to the US or the UK. I had family in both places and in Europe. Australia was very far away. I think we might have known some people there, nobody in New Zealand.
Right, yeah.
So it was an unknown place. But I was really excited to come here because of the potential that I saw in relation to my own research, because my work, my PhD work, was focused on Indigenous peoples in the Andaman Islands, and I looked at the impact of colonialism and post-colonialism, the ways it played out in people's lives and communities' lives. So the prospect of coming to New Zealand and then the potential for forging relationships with Māori was high on my list of the most promising things that could happen here.
Yeah. So you have been studying in the States, doing your PhD. And how long did you spend in the States?
In all, I spent 11 years.
Right.
So I was working over there as well. And I was in no hurry to finish my PhD. I'd made a huge jump. My undergraduate degree was in physiology, and then I did my master's in biochemistry.
Oh.
And then I decided I was sick of being a student and not having any money of my own.
I'm sure that will be quite familiar to
Yes,
many
I'd
students,
been studying yeah. since I was two. I'd been in institutions, educational institutions, since I was two, and I thought it was high time I left it. And so I looked for a job, and I looked for a job that just – I was looking for any job. And I got a job as a copywriter in an advertising agency, Clarion McCann. And I worked there for a couple of years. It was quite interesting. I was making some money. It felt like a lot, but at least I had some money of my own, and that was nice. And while I was there, actually stepping away from my stream of study and just having time, I started reading very widely and brought into a direction that I'd never engaged with before. I got really immersed in everything I was reading and so interested that I thought, maybe I should go back to studying. This is really interesting. I could follow this, and I've no idea where it'll take me, but it feels like the right place to be. And it came within the broad field of anthropology.
Wow, that's quite amazing, isn't it? It's quite, as you say, it's a jump to make, but also it's as if when you were released from the pressure of study that you actually found
where
your
I wanted
true
to
calling
be.
In a way.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. So in India, you can't switch disciplines that way. You can't. You follow a track, and you have to follow that track. And right. I imagine that's kind of the way it is in New Zealand as well. In order to be admitted somewhere, you need to show credentials.
Yes.
Or you need to study to accumulate those credentials. But so the only place that allowed you, it was on you if you wanted to make that jump, was the U.S.
Right.
So I did apply, and I applied to two places that I got admission into. It was Rutgers in New Jersey and Brown in Rhode Island. And in the end, the decision about where to go was made on really pragmatic grounds. It was cheaper to live. The fees and living costs, as was estimated in all the documents, was far less in New Jersey than it was at Brown. And given the exchange rates for currency in India, It was Rutgers that I decided I would go to. And because I was jumping ship disciplinary-wise, I was admitted, but they couldn't offer me a teaching fellowship, teaching assistantship, as they call it, the scholarship.
Right.
So what, how it works in the US is if you're offered a teaching assistantship, you get a fees waiver.
Right.
And then you work to as a support staff to a course.
Right.
So you're like a tutor. You're a tutor, basically.
And that pays your fees, and effectively.
Yes. Yeah. In some ways, it pays your fees, but it also gives you a stipend
right.
for your living cost. Yes. It's not a lot, but it felt like a lot. So when I went in, I went with just enough funds to cover the cost of one semester of study. Because my parents were really disappointed with me. There I was, jumping from one thing to another thing. I said I'd had enough of study, and there, after having studied all those years in the sciences, and I wanted no truck with that. Then I said I wanted a job, and I was going to make my life doing something in advertising. And then I decided, nah, that's not me. And now I wanted to go somewhere else. So it took a lot of persuasion, but I think I convinced them, and grudgingly they accepted that maybe that was what I wanted right. to do. But they were not going to risk putting so much funds yeah. towards that unless I proved myself.
You had to prove yourself.
I had to prove myself. So that first semester was very, very, very hard. Because there I was diving in deep at a level of study that I knew nothing about, four courses, and I had to make it because only if my grades were good enough would I be able to apply for a teaching assistantship.
Oh, I see, yeah.
So I think that first semester could be described as quite hellish.
Yeah. A lot of pressure on you, certainly.
A lot of pressure. Yeah. Yeah. You just had to find a way to make things work and rise to the challenges.
Okay.
And I think I was really lucky that I was in an environment. There were a group of people I knew who were traveling to Rutgers at the same time, and we all lived around each other. They were all in the same boat.
Yeah.
They had to make it. And yes, so why I was so lucky was at the end of that first semester, there was a vacancy in a teaching assistantship. Someone who had it was giving it back because she had an internship somewhere else that she wanted to go to. Yeah. And so there was that space.
Oh, great.
And so I applied and I got it.
Yeah.
And I never looked back.
So, Sita, when you accepted the job at Massey and came to Palmerston North, what was that move like? And how did it compare to the first time you moved countries?
So when I said I'd come here for an interview, and the thing that struck me, the string that was most prominent to me, was the kind of warmth and hospitality and generosity that I encountered in everyone I met. So that week that I was here in Palmerston North, I was talking to everybody, whoever I met. I was walking from one place to another and standing at bus stops and starting conversations and going into deep conversations with people and walking up and down the social science tower and then knocking on people's door and people talking to me. So I say that everyone who I talked to extended warmth, which was a really interesting phenomena because I had not encountered that in the US. People are very reserved. I've spent some time in the US. I'd spent some time in the UK. It takes a long time to make inroads into yes. people's lives.
Absolutely, yeah.
And here I was talking to people on the street and they invited me to come home for dinner.
Right.
One of my closest, best friends, I would say, my first friend in Palmerston North, Aroha Morgan, she was the travel agent working at the House of Travels who'd arranged my travel.
Right.
And it was a complicated route, so I had to go back to see her again so that my return back to the U.S. did not take that same complication.
Yeah.
So I went to meet her, and we got talking, and the next thing I knew, she'd taken me home with her.
That's lovely, isn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
And so it was very special. And I wanted to hold on to that to that feeling of warmth. I felt that it was something to be treasured. So when I came back, I encountered it again. Aroha had arranged for where I would stay. And then through her, I met other people in Palmerston North. And my department, my colleagues also kind of. So the first several months, I just felt enveloped in kindness, many kinds of kindnesses. And I almost felt like I was in a bubble, cushioned by all the people who continued to extend that kind of generosity and hospitality. I ate in so many people's homes. I was always, so my friends and family with whom I spoke about it, they said, you become such a social butterfly. You're never at home. And that was true.
Yeah.
For many, many weeks at a stretch, one meal or another meal was eaten in somebody else's house. So that was my first impression of Palmerston North and life in New Zealand.
So a nice start, really.
It was a very nice start.
Yeah.
And I'm so very grateful for that because that was what colored my experience of it. And I think I felt very lucky and privileged to have had that experience. Because I don't think that was the case with many other people.
No, certainly. I mean, I've spoken as part of the show, and otherwise I've spoken to a number of people. I think people's experience when they arrive is very varied, but it sounds as though that you were fortunate to be surrounded by a group of very welcoming people.
Yes.
And then got to know them and their contacts who also were the same types
exactly,
of people.
Exactly, exactly. So it was an overlapping networks that through that first initial set of contacts, I kind of settled in and found my feet.
So you've obviously stayed here. Is that in part, do you think, because you feel comfortable here? Or because you were a traveller before, you had, travelled to different places. So what is it, do you think, that has kept you here, I suppose?
It's an easy place to live and work. I think there was that little tagline for Palmerston North. I thought that described it perfectly.
Oh, was that the young heart easy living one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly that. It was. So to make a life for myself and combine work and home and becoming a parent. So my daughter was on the way when I arrived here. So she was born early. So that was a bit of a shock.
Oh.
She arrived 2 months early, but and so learning to parent and holding on to my job and doing all the things required of that job and finding a way to live over here was only possible, I think, because it was Palmerston North.
Right.
I cannot imagine having that kind of flexibility and ease in terms of what it took to get to work, what it took to look after my daughter the fact that the Massey childcare was just a flight of stairs up.
Yeah.
And I could go and breastfeed and come back and go on to do my class. The fact that when prior to her starting at the Massey creche, when I had to teach, I had graduate students around me who held her in the crook of their arms, and I could do what I needed to do. So I can't think of anywhere else where I could have achieved that sort of way of living,
yeah,
and found the niche I needed to combine my responsibilities as an academic, as a parent,
yeah,
and live a life.
Wow, that's an immense set of challenges to have to juggle all at once. But it sounds as though you made your way through it, well, with ease, as you said, really. So, looking back now, from, you know, you've been here, what,
24 years.
So, how does it feel now to be living in Palmerston North? Does it feel like this is your home, or and how are your connections back to friends in the States and friends and family in India? Like, how do you see yourself? I guess this is really a question about identity, really, at this point.
Yes.
How is it feeling to you?
So as a migrant, you make your life. Everything that you have is what you make yourself. You don't have anything to fall back on.
No.
So just very recently, my daughter and I were talking about this because she's writing her honors thesis that coincidentally has a lot to do with what we're talking about. So she's looking at Indian writers who write about diaspora in fiction. And some of the analysis that she's applying draws from the work of this very eminent scholar called Edward Said. And he writes, and he's written a lot about diaspora and exile. And he uses these two terms to describe it. He calls it filiative and affiliative ties. The filiatives are the ones that that bind you by blood, you know, from in your place of origin, all the networks of kin and extended family that make the life that you know. And then the affiliative are the ones, the new ones that you make that have nothing to do with blood, but are based on a whole set of other kinds of criteria. So with migrants, the affiliative is what is most important. Everything that you have, the people around you or not, are based on what you as an individual go on to do and make.
Yes.
So in many ways, you can say the life I know, the life I live, is what I have built.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And how easy or not it is, or how many challenges and obstacles you encounter to make that happen varies from place to place. And I suppose part of me saying in that earlier stretch of conversation that this was an easy place to live is saying that this was an easy place to forge affiliative relationships. And that has been key to me feeling like this is a place I want to be.
Right. Yeah.
I'm
loving the, I guess the academic approach that you're bringing to it. It's quite fascinating because a lot of people have talked about these things, but maybe not in those specific terms. And it's interesting to me to hear that there's a sector of research on it, and that these things are identified, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think on the whole that if we look at Palmerston North as a city, do you think there are any things that we could be doing differently to help migrants to make these affiliative ties quicker or better?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Having lived here, having the weight of a few decades now, I can see that even as I say all this about warmth and generosity and openness, there is another side to it.
Yeah.
And the other side of it you encounter only through a different set of experiences. So I think I'll describe an experience that has remained with me. That in many ways, as a brown woman in New Zealand, in Palmerston North, I have my academic persona and that work related life has been the center of my life. And that has been kind of encompassed most of what I do. You spend so much time with people in relation to work. And all the networks you know are kind of part of that. And Palmerston North is a small place. Almost so many people have something or another to do with Massey.
Yeah.
But outside of work, in some of the early years, I remember I had gone for Saturday morning soccer with my daughter. So Saturday morning soccer meant that you pull something on.
Yeah.
You have your
first thing
in the morning face.
Yeah.
You have your, I had my sweatpants and a sweatshirt. And then after dropping her Chileme off, I was at soccer and then we went to get lunch. And then I saw there was the women's expo or some such thing in the arena. I thought, let me go and check that out. So I was there in my unacademic look, And what was that? It was interesting that when I went in there looking as I did, and there were all these people, I won't mention the people by name. There was a local councillor and there were some other people. And they would stop and speak to different people, you know, making themselves known. There were goodie bags. And as I walked past and waited, it was like I was invisible.
Okay.
It was really interesting. Yeah. I was invisible at every turn as a recipient of a goodie bag or as a recipient of the counselor's spiel about something or another. And that was a really interesting kind of reckoning for me. Huh. This is new. I'm always used to being who I am.
We're in a scenario where you're known.
I'm known and
your expertise is acknowledged.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So here I was just someone anonymous.
Yes.
And I looked as I did.
Yeah.
Inconsequential.
Yeah.
And not possibly someone you don't need to pay attention to. And that I think that was the one occasion that has remained in my mind that taught me to think that all is not right. That I have experienced what I did in Palmerston North only because I've had the privilege of being attached to Massey.
Yeah.
And that comes with a certain kind of persona and social status.
And opened some doors.
And has opened several doors for me. And without that, it would be a whole other kind of place. And that was something I needed to be attentive to.
Well, I mean, I think that that is a very telling story and insight that you bring actually at the end. I'm not going to comment because obviously we don't, you know, we recognise that there's plenty of work still to be done in being a more welcoming city. But I think that's a very a good story, not good as in you know what happened, but it's a very telling story, and so a good place I think on which to end. So look, Sita, thank you so much for your time. We've had a lot to talk about, and you've brought some really fascinating new ideas, really, to me. I might have to go off and look at some anthropology thinking myself. But thank you for your time. We've loved
having
you on
Lorna,
the show.
Thank you, Lorna. I enjoyed it too.
Thank you. So people who've been listening to Making Palmy Home, I'm Lorna Johnson, and you can catch the show at npr.nz/show/Making Palmy Home. Cheerio.